Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and our physical therapists are back with us today, and we're going to talk about the ways our experiences and our environment contribute to the pain we feel and our health. Lori Tyne Brody, one of our guest physical therapists and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to have you back.
It is good to be here, Larry.
Jill Tyne Nissenbaum with us as well, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Jill, good to see you again. Thanks for joining in.
It's great to be here on this great, fabulous, sunny day.
It is indeed. And as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Are you dealing with pain you can't figure out, maybe? What questions do you have for our physical therapist? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Lori, let's start with you. Help us understand what this biopsychosocial approach is to health.
Absolutely, Larry. And it's a great way to start this out. So for most of us in our generation, I'll say, we grew up with a medical model of disease where, you know, disability or pain or medical problems are considered to be an individual problem, and they are treated within individualized medical care. You know, they look at the person or the individual as the source and sole reason for having whatever problem they're having, and the interventions are directed specifically at that person. So there's little regard to societal aspects of disability beyond things like public policy for public health related issues. So in a biopsychosocial model, which has been put forward by the World Health Organization, suggests that we function within a social environment, and that we have psychological and social factors that can impact our health and the quality of our life. So the model that's been put forth by the World Health Organization and has been adopted worldwide in nearly every medical specialty is a biopsychosocial model, where we look at the individual within the context of their social environment. What kind of social support do they have? You can imagine how somebody who has back surgery and has to recover from that at home, how that might be different for somebody who is unmarried, perhaps widowed in old age and has no children who live close by, as compared to somebody who has a spouse and family members close by who might be able to help them. It would be different for somebody who works at a desk job versus somebody who works at a blue collar job. It would be different for somebody who has to walk a long way to get to their job versus somebody who can commute via computer. So how we respond and how we recover from injury, trauma, surgery, etc., is not just a function of the individual, but it is contextual. It is that individual with their pre-existing psyche and their environment and their social support. So it's important as a provider to look at the person within the context of their life. And that really changes how we approach our interventions.
I was trying to think about this. Let's say somebody's got back pain. How do you incorporate that model to a patient who's experiencing back pain, for example?
So somebody like that, let's just use the examples that Lori provided. If they don't have a good social support system, perhaps they live farther away from their medical care. They live alone. They're a little bit more isolated. For someone like us, it may impact how often we can see them as a patient because they may not be able to get to us, things like that. So we may be designing a program, a rehabilitation program that teaches them how to progress appropriately. And it kind of gives them more a step-by-step procedure. Things that they have to be able to do on their own. For example, some exercises, it's great if you can have a spouse or a partner, somebody hold a band for you or, you know, help you get up and down off the floor. If they live by themselves, then that changes how we design that program. So we have to think about that, what they have access to in their home, and kind of design our program such that they can do all their exercises independently versus knowing they have a partner, significant other at home. It gives us more options, I guess, if you will, of how we manage that patient.
And when we think about that, and I think about designing that program for that person, my short-term goals are going to be focus more on getting them safely independent in their home. Mm-hmm. And that is, do you have stairs? Do you have handrails in your bathroom? How are you going to get to and from your bed to the bathroom at night? And so my program is going to be focused on those important skills at home to make sure that they're safe, as compared to general strengthening exercises or things like that. If they have a partner at home who I know can assist them. And in terms of the bigger societal picture for that individual who maybe lives far from healthcare and does not have support at home, they may require a skilled nursing facility for a short period of time until they can be independent. So the importance in terms of overall healthcare costs and society, this is a really important question, consideration.
And I, just reflecting back, I've been practicing almost 30 years. And I remember when I first started practicing as a therapist, we might ask one question about, and I remember my question, what do you like to do when you're not at work? What do you do for fun? And that was really all that I would get to about the patient beyond their medical condition. And now, teaching our physical therapy students, this is so important. This becomes at least half of your subjective interview to get this really good picture or snapshot of the patient, of what they do when they're not in front of you, so you can best meet them where they are with regards to their kind of position in society, socioeconomically, physically, et cetera.
So if I'm going to somebody and I've got back pain, let's say, as a consumer, I would want to, if I wasn't asked those questions by the person I was trying to deal with, as a client, I would be a bit suspicious, I guess.
Absolutely. And Larry, I know you. I have a general idea of where you live. So if you had back surgery, and one of the things we really like our patients with back pain or who have had back surgery to do is to get out and walk. I know in your neighborhood, you can get out and walk. There are people who I say, well, why don't you go out and take a walk? They cannot safely walk in their neighborhood. It is not safe. Or they may, it may be too hilly, or there may not be sidewalks where they live, or if they need a walker, they may not have curb cuts and they can't manage curbs. So considering that individual in their environment is critically important for making sure our clients are safe. And so when I think, how am I going to keep this person active for the rest of their life? And I have to consider where they live and how they live and do they have stairs and do they have an elevator and can they walk safely and so on when I think about how I'm going to keep them healthy for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. I'm wondering how can we talk or could we talk a little bit about the stigma associated with pain? Because a lot of times I've seen on TV or even, I don't know, I was trying to remember if I'd ever talked to anybody who was experiencing this, but feeling frustrated because people look at them like, you should be better.
That's right. That's completely right. And of course, pain is completely subjective. And again, in the medical model, we would simply say, we'd look at their x-ray and say, oh, look, your x-rays are fine. You should not be hurting. We don't understand why you hurt. There's nothing on your MRI. Your MRI is clean. And now we have this understanding with many conditions and diagnoses is there's no big correlation with imaging and how patients present. And so what's really important is treating the patient as they present to you. So we do know that there is a correlation between chronic pain and depression and anxiety. And so that's something that we consider very seriously. If we see an individual who's got a history of depression and anxiety, we know that they are at greater risk for chronic pain. So that's something that we oftentimes screen for. The biggest thing I think that we hear is that patients will come in and say, is this all in my head? People think I'm crazy. People tell me that, you know, my x-rays are fine, my MRI is fine, but I still have pain. And we don't question that. I don't question that for a second. Yes, I understand your pain is real. And unfortunately, the image we have doesn't validate it. But you still have to treat the patient in front of you. And the big push now is to not so much focus on what you can't do, but kind of talk about a little bit more on the positive thing of what you can do. And that was something that the article that Lori and I kind of started with today presented a little bit, was talking about more the positive of it versus just trying to suppress the negative.
Right. And, you know, when patients come in, you know, here at UW, we are required to ask patients their pain level every day, despite the science that suggests that we should not be focusing on patients' pain, but it is a requirement here. So when patients, you know, look at me and they roll their eyes like, oh, you know, I have a high pain tolerance. Well, that's fine. And what I say to people is the absolute number doesn't matter that much to me, because pain is a personal experience. What we're looking for is trends in pain. Is your pain increasing as we, you know, administer this intervention? Are we getting better, or is it heading the wrong direction? Are there things that clearly shift your pain one direction or another? That's really the focus of trying to get people to give us a number to nail down what their pain level is. But Jill's absolutely right. There are psychological states that make it more likely for one person to transition from acute to chronic pain. And that's part of that biopsychosocial model. And she's also correct that having a positive affect has been shown to mediate chronic pain, as well as social support mediates right. pain. So that's where the importance of these social aspects of looking at the individual and what kind of social support they have is important, because it buffers people against chronic pain.
Mackenzie Cremy, our producer, was telling me about how a doctor put it into a kind of a perspective. He said, if you stub your toe and you're having a bad day, you're going to feel more pain than if you stub your toe and you're having a good day. That's sort of a simplification of what you're talking about here, I think.
But it's a great analogy, and it's very true. It gets to the whole concept of pain catastrophizing. And, you know, if you already have kind of a negative affect or negative beliefs about the condition, that small little pain becomes a big pain. Yeah. So the other thing is, you know, a lot of people with chronic pain, their pain really runs their life. And I remember when I was working with the general population, I remember I had patients that would say to me, I'd say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And they'd have to say, well, I don't know, I just have to see how my day goes. And I didn't have that appreciation until I had a bout of neck pain. And I will never forget this. Lori asked me the question. There was a guest lecturer coming to town. And she said, are you going to go see Shirley? She's this world famous PT. And I said, I'm going to have to wait and see how my day goes, because I was having this neck pain. And it was such an aha moment for me that for people with chronic pain, you can get to the point where the pain really does run your life. Hmm. And I had that revelation. Unfortunately, I have good social support, things like that. And I dug myself out of that hole. But it was that aha moment for me to realize how patients get there and how that pain can really run their life.
Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody, our guest today, our physical therapist from the UW-Madison. I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe you have a question relating to what we've been talking about the last 20 minutes or so. Or maybe you have another physical therapy issue that you want to have addressed. Join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. As I said, Mackenzie Crummies, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at physical therapy on the show today with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Lori, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. James in Fond du Lac County has been waiting a bit. James, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm about 65 now, and I'm about 6 feet tall, and I weigh about 157 pounds my whole life. And when I got married 35 years ago, my wife is a registered nurse, and she decided that I was on a diet headed towards death. We were using lard for cooking, and we were eating butter, and we were drinking whole milk. And she put the family on a low-cholesterol, low-fat diet. So it was margarine, skim milk, and after about a year, I could hardly stand the pain in my knees and my shoulders.
Interesting.
Huh. And one day I finally said, the food tastes like nothing. Let's go back to what we were eating and just moderate it a little bit. And went back to whole milk, butter, and cooking with lard or bacon grease. And I don't know about her, I don't think she ever had any of the aches and pains I did, but no more problems with my knees, no more problems with my shoulders, and I just feel a whole lot better.
Hmm. Any comments on that, James wonders.
Well, go ahead, Jill.
There could be something with regards to the margarine or something within the ingredients of those that are highly processed foods. That may have kicked off some inflammatory mediators in you systemically. So it may have been more of an inflammatory diet for you, and the perhaps the whole milk diet, the butter diet, maybe those products weren't nearly as processed as the other products, and that may be the difference, Lori. That's kind of the first thing that comes to mind for me.
Yeah, I don't, you know, typically the dairy products are going to be the more inflammatory. So, you know, maybe it potentially could be that your gut was used to processing those kinds of foods. And when you changed it, you didn't, you weren't able to process some of the helpful ingredients out of the change in your diet. I'm not sure. That almost be a question for the dietitian.
Right.
But typically it goes the other way when people switch their diet to the healthier substances. Now, did you make any other changes in your diet or your lifestyle at that time? Or is that the only thing you changed?
Well, here's a good question. So often we hear on PBS and maybe on through magazines and public radio too, it's a lot better if you stay away from processed foods. Now, what do they exactly mean by processed foods?
So, well, processed foods are things that, for lack of a better term, take the original natural ingredients and they process them. They heat them, they separate them, they beat them, they reconfigure them with other ingredients instead of eating, you know, basically what we would call lower on the food chain.
Yeah, and so I'm trying to think of some examples of
So
white bread, highly processed white bread is kind of a classic example versus a multigrain bread, which has the grain still somewhat in their natural content, which hasn't been processed a whole bunch. So, you know, like cooking flour is highly processed food. That's a really good example.
Yeah. And I think in James's comment, though, when they did go back to that, they went they took a less aggressive approach to the amounts they were eating. Mm-hmm. And so they went back to to using butter, using drinking milk, but were a little more careful on the amounts. And that probably was helpful too. James, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Maggie in Ridgeland a chance to join in. Maggie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I'm calling in on behalf of my husband, who has a chronic headache. He always has a headache, and then sometimes it gets so bad it just puts him down in bed for a few days. And he's had an MRI, and the fellow didn't find anything. He had a traumatic brain injury when he was young, and he thinks it might be from that after all these years. From a motorcycle wreck, but we just don't know. And then I thought maybe it was from shingles, from a time when he had shingles. It's just, they didn't find anything except that his neck is really tight. And so he's been seeing somebody about his neck. So it's odd, and we don't know what to do.
It sounds a lot like a mechanical headache. The one thing that I always ask people who have kind of continuous headaches is he hypertensive or is he on any high blood pressure medication, Maggie?
Yes. He's on amlodipine.
Is his blood pressure well controlled?
Yeah, it's pretty controlled now, yeah.
Okay, great. Because that's just always something you worry about.
He's a diabetic.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's probably what we would call a cervicogenic headache. Mm-hmm. And you can often get headaches that are related to your cervical spine. And he may have what we would consider a lower threshold for getting a headache because of his previous traumatic brain injury. He's someone who would always be more susceptible to having headaches or that type of pain over the course of his lifetime. With that history, people with TBIs are more prone to chronic pain in general. Potentially related to the brain injury, although we're not exactly clear on the mechanism for that, but we do see that correlation. So if he is tight in his neck, then he may have a lower threshold for developing a cervicogenic headache. So it makes sense that, first of all, clearing everything else up, and we could speak to our brother who had headaches for years. And speaking of social support, his wife drug him to the doctor one day, and he had a very large brain tumor, but it was growing slowly. So it was like the frog in the pot of water that, you don't realize how bad it's getting. And so the first thing to do is to rule out anything like that, which they have done with the MRI and a thorough medical exam. Looking at medication, could that be causing the headaches, and ruling all those things out. And then now seeing that correlation with his neck pain and treating it as a cervicogenic headache and see if that improves his symptoms.
So what would, under those kinds of circumstances, what sort of treatment would that entail?
So if there's a lot of tightness in the muscles, it's a lot of postural correction and stretching. For some people, we will dry needle those suboccipital muscles or the trapezius muscles. They can all refer to the head and cause a headache. It might be increasing mobility in the joint of the cervical spine, so their head is in a better position and they're not kind of really kind of shearing or kind of doing excessive loading through a certain part of their cervical spine. It may be down into the chest, doing some chest stretching to increase mobility there as well. So it'll kind of be working kind of from the sternum up to kind of increase mobility, make sure posture's in a good position. And so those muscles aren't referring back to the head.
It's sounding like a PT, a physical therapy kind of session.
Absolutely, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Or sessions, probably more, mm-hmm. certainly
right.
more than one.
Right.
But yep. That's something to think about, Maggie. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Sims in Madison, we'll move to you next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a bulging disc thing happening, and I think I'm doing everything right, and I've had enough, and I'm looking for, like, make this go away. I got a different car a year ago, and one day I couldn't get out of it. It was just lower back stuff. I had an MRI recently, and L5 has got an extruding disc, and it's just excruciating, and I'm living on ibuprofen and Tylenol, and I'm going to PT, and there's a thing called the Egoscue method, Pete Egoscue, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. postural kind of stuff. and it's like the equation. I'm doing it all, and it still hurts. So I'm wondering, when you mentioned with your previous caller, you know, the large tumor, that's what we all fear. It's like, oh, my God, I've got that somewhere. But we did the MRI.
Right.
So I don't know if I'm asking you to hold my hand and saying, just keep it up. It takes time. you know, mm-hmm. but it,
so,
I'm wondering
so let me,
if there's anything.
So let's start with this. Where is your pain? Is it in your legs or is it in your back?
I can watch it. It used to be all the way down to my toes. And
okay.
I've watched it pull all the way back up. And I'm so focused on this. I know where L5 is and I can feel it. Like even last night, it woke me in the middle of the night. So it goes back and forth. When it's bad, it goes all the way down my leg. But usually it's just right there at L5,
okay.
right at that nerve, the sciatic.
So the fact that you are centralizing your pain or getting your pain to come all the way from your foot to your back is a sign of very good progress. That's what we like to hear. We like to hear that your pain is centralizing. It's not peripheralizing. So any movements or motions that you do that keep your pain in your back and do not cause it to peripheralize are what we call really good things. How long has it been since you've kind of been battling this, I guess?
Well, basically a year off and on, and now in the last month, it's gotten to the point of excruciating. You know, you're 10 out of 10. Writing, that kind of stuff.
What brings your pain on?
Yeah, that's what I don't know. I mean, walking, standing.
So are you still in physical therapy?
Yeah, I'm going this afternoon again. UW, thank you very much.
All right, and what are they doing for you?
Well, I haven't seen them since I did the MRI, but primarily press-ups.
Okay. Stop right there. Are the press-ups increasing your pain?
No, but they're not making it go away.
Okay. So press-ups, I sometimes see people who have been told to do press-ups, or they go online and they see the McKenzie method, and they start doing press-ups before the disc is ready to go into extension. So if you can think about it mechanically, you've got this sort of concave lumbar spine. And if you have a disc extrusion out the back on the concave side, and you go up into further extension or that concave position, you're going to pinch that disc bulge, and that's going to really aggravate it. So see the physical therapist today. They will review the MRI and examine you, but you may not be ready for press-ups yet. You can be really annoying that if you're doing press-ups too frequently or too vigorously. So, yeah, go ahead, Jill.
I'm gonna give you, I love your analogy, Lori. I'm going to give you a better analogy. We call it the horse's head is too far out of the barn. So you think of a horse and it's a half door, and the horse has stuck their head out of that half door, and you're trying to close the door from the top, and you run into the horse's head, and you want to try and get the horse to wiggle their head back in. So that's what you do when you go into extension. You're decapitating the horse. And so we say the horse's head is too far out of the barn. So what you have to do sometimes is you might have to open the barn door up a little bit more. So you might have to go into flexion or unload them, and then they'll kind of nudge their nose back in. And then you can start to go into extension and kind of get them to put their nose back in. So the analogy I give people is our horse's head is too far out of the barn. I don't know. I think it works. Apparently, Lori lost it.
It doesn't work for me at all.
Oh, sorry. I'll draw you a picture.
But if other people get it, carry on.
I'll draw your picture over Christmas.
If it requires a picture, it's too complicated.
Yeah. So back to our patient. It does sound like he likes to be unloaded, though, because I hear him say standing doesn't work. And so, you're right, Lori. The extension might be too much, and he may need to be unloaded a little bit longer.
Yeah, send him to the pool.
Right.
Yeah. There. So, Sims, there you go. Some things to talk about with your physical therapist this afternoon at your appointment for sure. Thanks for calling. Wayne and Sobieski, we'll go to you. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Good morning. Well, I've been listening to your show forever, and I listen to the ladies when they're on all the time. I don't have insurance, and I have a bad ankle. I've had a bad ankle since I was a kid. And every time I'd go in, like if I turned an ankle playing softball or baseball or whatever, a couple times I went into the hospital and they told me it was terrible. And they give me this air splint thing. And I'm 53, so this was a long time ago. But they'd put this air thing on one side and air thing on the other, and you kind of Velcro it around itself. Or tied up with shoelaces. And that's all they ever did. And then a week later, I'd be playing basketball again or whatever team I was playing on at the time. I'd be back playing and it never got better. Well, it was fine. Not fine, but it was, crappy for years, but never hurt. And now, like the last, maybe 8-10 months, it's been lousy. And my ankle's always swollen on the right. That's my right ankle. And it's always got that big bulge on the outside of the ankle. And I'm sure it's because of what I wear for shoes. But I wear Crocs all the time when I'm not working and boots when I am working because boots support me. But Crocs feel good.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, so it sounds like you probably have what we call chronic ankle instability, and there's compelling research that shows that if you sprain your ankle one time and you don't have adequate or any rehabilitation, you're going to be bound to do it again. So my best guess is with your extensive history, you've kind of had some chronic sprains and, done some ligamentous damage to the outside or the lateral side of your ankle. And then what's happening now over time is you're just getting this little bit of what I call micro instability. So when you walk, the joints may be rubbing together a little bit inappropriately and causing this chronic pain. So without any rehabilitation whatsoever, I think that's probably why you're in the boat you're in. I hear you say you're uninsured, but I do think a few physical therapy visits to get you doing some good appropriate rehab with some progression would be a good idea. Lori, thoughts?
Yeah. I'm not sure where you live, if there's a clinic that does a cash basis. So a clinic that will bill you based upon your ability to pay and paying cash rather than using insurance would be useful. Otherwise, there's probably a number of strengthening programs that you could find online, and you could probably buy some resistive bands from someplace by Amazon. Like Amazon to incorporate some strengthening. The question is how much instability you have at this time and whether you would need additional advice about, supportive shoes. Do you have a flat foot? Did you potentially have a high ankle sprain that's going to potentially progress to some fairly significant ankle arthritis that should be looked at and addressed, and prevention issues incorporated as well. So, there are a couple other things that are potentially going on in addition to the chronic ankle instability that you might want to know about at this point in time in terms of how you pick your intervention. So maybe a visit would be good. See if you can find a clinic that will do a cash basis.
Yeah. Good luck, Wayne. Thank you so much for calling. Ted in Spooner, your turn. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, my shoulder's been bothering me, and I've been going to the Minneapolis VA, and they done x-rays on the shoulder or the bones, and they said, for my age, it's pretty good. and they had me move around because I can put my arm above my head and all that stuff. So I said, it ain't a rotator cuff. But my elbow hurts. My two small fingers on the hand is numb all the time.
And nobody looked at your neck, Ted? Nobody looked at your neck, Ted?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, that's the next place.
So shoulder pain typically does not, primary shoulder pain doesn't extend beyond your elbow typically. So if you're having pain in your elbow, we start to think this isn't a shoulder problem. Then when you have numbness in your two little fingers, now that's coming from your neck. So it's possible that you could have something going on around your elbow that's causing the numbness in your fingers, since you're also having elbow and finger symptoms. But I would say if you're also having shoulder pain and they can't find anything on exam in your shoulder, that it's probably your neck. And just as an FYI, just because you can get your arm overhead doesn't mean you don't have a rotator cuff problem. So just for future listeners. So you can have a completely torn rotator cuff and still get your shoulder overhead.
So Ted should be going back and talking to about
have them
his
look
neck.
At your neck.
I would have him look at his neck. And if his neck is clear, then I'd look for cubital tunnel syndrome or something like that in his elbow.
Right. Ted, did you tell them that your fingers were numb when you were there?
I mean, I've been trying to figure things out just below my elbow, by the bone. I can rub my fingers around and all of a sudden it'll send shocks right down to my two fingers.
Yeah, so it could be a primary elbow problem as well. So, you need a more thorough exam. So, and sometimes I tell my patients this when they come in for a certain problem, and then because we get to spend a lot of time with them. It's one of the things I love about being a PT is we have a lot of time to talk to our patients, and they'll start telling me about these other symptoms. And I ask them, have you told your doctor about these? And often the response is no. So it's like your care provider can't help you unless you give them the full picture of what's going on. And just because in your head, you don't know that it's associated, sometimes it is associated, and the provider will make that link for you.
Right.
So get back to that provider, Ted, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody, our guest today, as we take a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Do you have an ache, a pain, a sprain, or a strain that is bothering you and you need some help and advice? This is the place. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tine-Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer at UW-Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Questions, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take an email. Jim from Fox Valley emailed and said he's 74. He's been running for 50 years. His left knee started to feel sore, and he hasn't run in 6 weeks and wants to know where to start, with an orthopedic doctor or a knee physical therapist. He also wants to know about Synvisc injections.
So I think it sounds like this is a really good call for Jim to see a physical therapist. So a physical therapist would be able to evaluate Jim. And if there is a condition that is beyond the care of a physical therapist, that physical therapist would refer Jim on appropriately to see a physician. But it sounds to me like if he's been running for a very long time and he's laid up for 6 weeks, which is probably for him a lifetime, I do think starting with seeing a physical therapist, and again, Lori always asks the question, if you're doing a bilateral activity, why is it only that one side? That would be a really good thing for a physical therapist to evaluate in this individual.
Right, exactly. And, you don't necessarily need to start with the physician at this point, because most of the time the physician is going to refer you to physical therapy. Mm-hmm. unless you've had an acute injury, a fall, a big swollen knee, or some mechanism. But if you stopped running because your knee hurt, that suggests some type of overuse problem, which is non-surgical. So you would start with physical therapy, and that person, as Jill said, would look at both sides and try to figure out why one and not the other, give you some activities to hopefully remediate your symptoms, coach you on how to get back to running. And if that physical therapist thought that there was some medical intervention that would help move things along, whether it be a Synvisc injection or else, that person would do that. Synvisc would be useful in the case of some mild arthritis in the knee. If it, for example, is a kneecap problem or a tendon problem or a bursa problem, Synvisc won't help with that.
Yeah, and I, of course, it comes up a lot because I had it all those injections maybe 10 years ago. And it, I mean, I put, 9,000-10,000 miles on exercise miles on over that time with no pain, basically. So it's been, it could be great, but it's not a cure-all for everything, as you say, Lori. That's for
right,
sure.
Right, right. And that's where someone in the medical profession would take a look at Jim's knee and determine if it was likely to be successful. So, you know, they could inject Synvisc in anybody's knee, but we know in some cases it will not be successful. So there's no purpose in going there at that point.
Let's go to Barb in Wabino. Barb, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Say, my husband is going to be 65 in February and is scheduled for a total hip replacement. I did orthopedic nursing in the 80s where everyone had an A-frame pillow and log roll, couldn't get out of bed for a week. And now they're talking about an anterior approach, walking out the door of the hospital that day. Can you tell me the pros and cons of the old-time procedure to the new one in terms of rehab?
So it sounds to me like you're wanting to know about the posterolateral approach versus the anterior approach. So the posterolateral approach, which is kind of what we think of when we do a traditional total hip replacement, the downside is they have to cut through the gluteus medius and then kind of reattach that. And we know that the gluteus medius is a really important muscle for kind of stabilization in the frontal plane or having you drop your hip. An anterior approach, the precautions are different. It's extension and I think external rotation and adduction, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And yeah. And so the incision is different. It's gluteus medius sparing. But the concerns about it or the it's still far from perfect in that you have to be really careful from a scarring concern that people don't end up with a tight hip flexor and tight structures in the front. And I will tell you anecdotally, my husband, who is also a physical therapist, sees a lot of these. And from a rehab perspective, anecdotally, he would tell you he prefers the posterolateral approach. He's had a few people that have run into significant trouble because they haven't done their activities in prone. They've scarred down and ended up with really tight hip flexors. And Lori is shaking her head yes.
Well, because you're also operating near an important neurovascular bundle.
Right. Yes.
Coming down the front of the hip. So... it's a risk factor when you're operating and you're moving around an important neurovascular bundle in that area. So, gluteus, we've been rehabbing these for many years and the people who have a posterolateral approach, you know, they do well.
Right.
I mean, they really do well. They get their gluteus medius back. I don't see people very often after a primary total hip replacement. I typically see them if they have additional back pain or they also have knee pain and they can't get in the positions or postures they need to get into in order to do their rehab independently.
I think one of the things, Barb, I would ask your surgeon is, you know, What are their outcomes like with the posterolateral approach versus the anterior approach? Because I'm guessing they're probably trained in both. And if they have a preference for one over the other, why is that? And get a little bit more information regarding that. Because every surgeon has, even though it's an anterior approach, they may have a little bit different technique, use different tools, things like that. So I think it'd be good for you to kind of gather all that information prior to making this decision.
Yeah, that makes sense to me for sure. Barb, thank you very much and good luck to your husband. Kind of along with this, Ed from McFarland emailed and is asking about when back surgery is required after physical therapy hasn't worked.
Okay, so well, surgery is not required. It may be the next choice. And so, you know, some of the things that you look at are, what is the underlying pathology? So I'm going to go back to the biopsychosocial model. So yes, we're looking at pathology. We're looking at the medical model, and we're looking at, were all the interventions, conservative interventions tried first? And, did you have sufficient physical therapy? Were you able to do the rehabilitation exercises that were recommended for you? I can't tell you how many times people don't do the dosage of exercise in physical therapy is insufficient to get them where they need to go. So in contrast to, as Jill said, you know, 30 years she's been in this, you can imagine I've been in it longer, she likes to tell you.
Yes.
Physical therapy has changed. We used to see these people in clinic 3 times a week, and we made sure that they did their exercises. Now we see them, we give them things to do at home, and, you know, biopsychosocial, life gets in the way. I can't get up and down off the floor. I don't have a place to do them, you know, whatever other factors in life get in the way. So the first question is, did you have a sufficient dosage of exercise to get better? And then in terms of having surgery, for example, did you have an epidural steroid injection with a positive result that would suggest that that surgery is actually going to be successful? Other times when surgery really is indicated is if you're having things like bowel and bladder changes, if you're having sanal anesthesia, if you're tripping and falling, signs that you're having significant compression on your spinal cord. And Jill shaking her head, she wants to talk, I can tell.
No, I just completely agree with you, Lori, on, you know, there's a handful of times where surgery, I think, is required. And you hit the nail on the head when you have progressive neurological weakness, when your leg is getting weaker, not getting better, when you have saddle anesthesia. So if you sat where you sit on a bike seatle, that is numb. And then when you have loss of bowel and bladder, those are really the kind of conditions that we consider where surgery is probably required versus an elective. So but like Lori said, you really want to exhaust all the conservative therapies first, all the conservative interventions before you go down this path. And you want to know what the outcomes are, like how good is the surgery going to be? If I do this, is this going to be, do they have a 90% success rate? What's going on? So those are things that are important to consider. And the biosocial is important. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I ask people when they come to me or they're a patient, they're like, I'm considering surgery. Should I have surgery? That's where I pull out that one class in health economics that I had. And you look at the margin for improvement. How much better can you get? How much better can you expect to get from surgery as compared to where you are now? So, for example, the patient with knee pain is saying, well, I'm thinking about having knee surgery. You know, I can't kneel. I like to garden. I like to kneel in my garden. I can't do that. And I look at him and say, chances are you're not going to be able to kneel after a knee replacement either. So what are the things you're hoping to improve? What's the margin between where, or the gap between where you are now and where you hope to be? And can surgery get you there? Or how far can they close that gap, and at what risk? So those are the things you really have to weigh.
Well, I have to weigh there for sure. for sure. Well, Mary from Superior was wondering about bursitis or fluid-filled sac. She has one on the inside of her knee, but said it comes and goes and wonders why.
So, so bursas are fluid-filled sac. Mary is correct on that. I'm guessing she's referring to her pes anserine bursa.
Yeah.
So there's a bursa around your knee. It's kind of lower, a little bit lower than your knee on the inside. And there are some tendons that attach right in that area. And there's a bursa there. And so I think Mary's asking why some days it's thicker than others. And it's probably activity related. If she's using those muscles that insert there, with greater frequency and she's getting some friction or some rubbing, that could be something that would cause that bursa to be inflamed or a bursitis.
Yeah. Most likely time on her feet is going to be what causes that. And if she has a little malalignment at her knee, it's going to, you know, potentially overload if she's standing, walking more. And that's fairly common of any kind of itis, whether it's bursitis, tendonitis, it'll come and go. Depending upon your activity.
Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody, our guests today, and they are going to be with us right up till 12:30 as we talk physical therapy issues. Lots of people online. You can join in. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org or the phone number 800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jill and Lori. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two physical therapy guests, Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And taking your questions, where our lines are all filled, you can email us to ideas@wpr.org if you'd like to do that. In the meantime, let's go to Reggie in Oshkosh. Reggie, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, a lot of times it feels like the ligaments or tendons in like my shoulders or my knees are just not in the right place. And if I put pressure on them and sort of move around, they can pop where they're supposed to be, and the relief of pain is incredible, but it's like all day, every day, and it's constant pain.
Has this been, Reggie, has this been most of your life?
I'd say most of my adult life.
Okay. Are you thinking hypermobile?
I am. Is that what you were thinking?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So, you know, that just from the top of our heads, the symptoms you describe sound like someone who has underlying joint hypermobility. It tends to produce chronic pain in people because their muscles are overworking, trying to stabilize their joints, which are inherently unstable. So, you know, having pain, putting pressure on something until it feels like it moves back into place is a symptom of underlying hypermobility, particularly if it happens in multiple joints. So if it only happens in one joint or both shoulders, then maybe it could just be a localized problem. But if it happens all over your body, we start thinking hypermobility. So is there anything you can add to that, Reggie?
I can roll my pelvis and feel like lower lumbar vertebrae moving around when I lay down to sleep at night. Also my upper vertebrae in my back, I can just move my shoulders and everything pops and moves around. And basically I just feel like, you know, one of those display skeletons that was put together way too loose.
Okay. Well, that's actually a really good analogy.
It is.
So it does sound like this could be a systemic condition for you. And physical therapists can treat individuals with hypermobility. It is a lot of education. and learning about the appropriate exercises that are good for you to foster stability in these joints. And it's learning how to manage fatigue in those muscles and things like that. So it's a long process, and it needs to be very individualized because everybody's degree of hypermobility is different, as well as the joints in which it impacts. But, you know, you're from a pretty metro area. There's lots of physical therapists in the Oshkosh area, and you should be able to find a physical therapist that can treat you from a hypermobility perspective and get you on the right path.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are also specific garments that sometimes are recommended, mm-hmm. Compression garments that help, for lack of a better phrase, hold things together a bit. But they give you more tactile cues of stability. And are you somebody who likes to stretch? You feel like, oh, it feels great to stretch?
Constantly stretching.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing that anecdotally I hear from people, and I think it's because they don't fire their joint receptors until they get really far into the range of motion. So whereas a normal person with just sort of reaching and moving through their daily activities will set off their joint receptors to give their brain feedback about where they are in space, but people who are hypermobile constantly feel that need to stretch, and I think they have to really get far into the end range before they fire off that receptor that says, oh, that feels good. So it's something I hear a lot from people who are hypermobile. So I would get that checked out.
Good luck, Reggie. Thank you so much for calling. And on to Chris in Fifield. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Okay, I don't know really if this is a physical therapy question, but I have pain above my larynx on the left side, and it comes and goes. It seems to be associated a lot with post-nasal drip, which is all on just the left side. And I've gone to a dentist, and they've ruled out anything. They took x-rays. They said it's not TMJ. But it comes and goes, seems to be worse in the winter, dry air, but it's just kind of weird. I've had ultrasounds. I've seen ENTs. They've taken those exams. Can't seem to find anything. One doctor said it may be GERD, put me on a prescription medication for that. That didn't really seem to do anything. It started last year. It wasn't too bad. Definitely enough to see an ENT. But now this year it started in that it's just a small area, but it's like on the top of the larynx on the left side. And that's, I also, if I get hoarse, it seems I have to clear my throat really hard. It seems almost like there's a little pocket there. And once I get it out, then I'm okay. It's not like I'm clearing my throat all day or anything. But I'm just wondering if that is associated with this post-nasal drip. If there's I have been on, last week they put me on 10 days of antibiotics. That didn't do anything.
I was going to say, have you seen a speech language pathologist?
Yeah, because you just took that right out of my head.
Oh, good. Yep. That's what happens when I interrupt you. sorry. So this sounds, Chris, like perhaps it's something that a speech language pathologist would be the best individual to see. They specialize in vocal cord, oral things, all of that. Yeah. So I think seeing an SLP is probably the best person to start with. And Lori may have something to add.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that, especially given where you're having your symptoms. Right. And again, as we start at the top of the hour, they've ruled out a lot of things. Right. They've ruled out a lot of medical things that could be causing it. And now you want to spend some time with somebody who will, you know, kind of really sit down and look at that area and examine it. And especially when you talked about the hoarseness, mm-hmm. I would go to an SLP next.
Yeah.
Speech language pathologist.
Okay. Yes. So they're a teammate of ours in a multidisciplinary mm-hmm. setting, particularly when we work with patients. For example, somebody who's had a stroke, we may be working with OT on activities of daily living, and the speech language pathologist may be working with them on speech communication, things like that. So they're definitely one of our colleagues, peers that we work with in certain environments.
Good luck, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Carl in Eagle River, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi, good morning. Afternoon. Am I on?
Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
Thank you. So I have had a pain in my left shoulder and went to a surgeon. He recommended a shoulder replacement 3 years ago. I've been doing exercises, and this spring I had pain in my right shoulder and went back to him, and of course he had done x-rays before. 3 years ago, and he did x-rays again, and he examined my right shoulder and suggested I get an MRI, which I did. The result is that he suggests rotator cuff surgery. And I've got the results of the MRI in front of me, and what it says is that the rotator cuff posterior supraspinatus tendon has small, intermediate, high-grade, partial thickness, articulocited tear at the attachment. Mm-hmm.
Yep, we know what that means.
Okay.
Yeah. And,
is that it?
Since then, I've started physical therapy, and since the spring, the pain, my main concern was the pain at night, and that has been getting better.
Great.
But they also found elongated intratendinous cysts, 3.9 centimeters. And also, of course, when they go in with an MRI, they find all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Sure, right. Many of which can be incidental.
So what should he be doing?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that, those minor tears in his rotator, in his supraspinatus tendon, those are not a surgical case.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jill.
Oh, so I guess it's very interesting information, Carl, and I'm glad you brought it up. But first of all, I think trying conservative care first and foremost is the way to go. So it sounds like you're seeing a physical therapist and you are getting better in that the night pain is getting under control, which is wonderful. I as a general rule, for small cuff tears like this, if I had surgery, and that's a big if, I would have a debridement. I would just have things cleaned up and go about my day, because you have a lot of your rotator cuff still intact, and that can certainly be sufficient to get by. Lori shaking her head yes.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to take me to surgery kicking and screaming at this point.
Right.
So if your primary problem is still night pain, before I ever went to surgery, I would consider a subacromial bursa injection, because it's the subacromial bursa that tends to give you more night pain than anything else in your shoulder, I think. And again, that's just sort of anecdotally from what I've seen. Because you're the rotator cuff, that supraspinatus tendon, and the long head of your biceps, and your subacromial bursa all sit in a very small space between two bones in your shoulder, between that roof of the acromion up there, that point on your shoulder, and the top of your humerus, the shoulder bone. So when you're moving around during the day, things kind of stay in, symbiosis. But then at night when you lay down, that bursa can swell, and that'll give you some pain at night. So it's diagnostic in that if you go in and you're still struggling with pain at night and you just can't sleep well, trying an injection first will help determine if you are a good surgical candidate, if you're likely to get improvement with surgery. If they inject that bursa and you're not much better, then, going in and sort of cleaning some of that stuff up isn't necessarily going to have the outcome you're looking for. But I would agree with Jill, absolutely start with conservative first.
Good luck. Thank you, Carl, for calling. And Nick in Green Bay, we turn to you now. Hi, Nick.
What do we have to have him? Now that I heard that shoulder question, I got two questions for you. The first one is, I broke my collarbone on June 9th. What was it? The tibia? Is that what it was? I think.
Clavicle.
Thank you. That's exactly what it is. On June 9th, and it's not healing. So they gave me a bone stimulator, but they're sending me to Milwaukee for a specialist. My question is, is it going to end up having to have surgery if it doesn't heal pretty soon? And then my other question is, I want to exercise, but I'm really scared about exercising because both shoulders are really screwed up. Like tomorrow, you're talking about that injection. Tomorrow I'm going in at 8 o'clock to get some injection, and they're using an ultrasound to put it in the joint.
Yeah,
great. I know what I'm talking about. Not really. Perfect. Cortisone doesn't work, and so...
No, that's a different injection, though, than I was talking about. They're injecting your joint, and that's different.
Okay, so you have a clavicle fracture, and it's been treated conservatively, and it's not healing. Is that the deal?
My Dr. Metz said that the outside is healing, but the inside is not. He's like, it's like an egg right now. If you look at my shoulder, it's huge. It's massive.
Yeah, so you did not have surgery on it. They're just hoping that these two little ends find each other and heal, yes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. Do you think it's going to end up in the surgery? Or?
Okay, well, if you have the egg going, and how long have you had the bone stimulator?
About a month now, and that makes me sick because I was told after the chip burns out, you just throw it away, and that's like $3,000. I'm like, are you serious? Oh, yeah.
Why is your insurance not paying for that?
Workers' comp is actually, but it just still makes me sick to throw it away.
Yes, I totally hear you on that. Okay, all right, so you have that going. And so you're going to go see somebody in Milwaukee tomorrow, and they're doing an ultrasound and guided injection at the joint.
That's Purveya tomorrow at 8 o'clock in Green Bay here.
Okay, so you're having an ultrasound guided injection into the fracture area, or where is this going?
This one's going in the right one that they don't know what's wrong with it. They're not quite sure what is wrong with it. Their hypothesis was it was a frozen shoulder, but now they don't know what's going on with it.
So like this, this is the other shoulder?
Yeah, I screwed up both shoulders. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that makes sense. So you have lots going on here.
Right.
So let's get to the question. Can you exercise? How does a recumbent bike sound?
Mm-hmm.
So I totally hear your hesitancy with your upper extremity, and I would not feel comfortable with what you have told us thus far with your shoulders about implementing something in your upper extremity. But what I would tell you is that exercising your lower extremity and getting some good blood flow and circulation would be fantastic. So for someone like you, I would highly recommend a recumbent bike would be great because you can sit and exercise, get your heart rate up, and I think something along those lines would be a really good form of exercise for you. Lori, do you have other suggestions?
Well, of course, you know me. We could put you in a pool. I wouldn't want you immersed with your arms, with resistance to your arms. So I'd probably have your arms resting on a kickboard or on a noodle or something and keeping the water relatively shallow. But walking in a pool, I think, would also be good. The only issue would be a risk of slips and falls. That you're going to have there that you don't have on a recumbent bike.
Right.
Yeah. Stationary bike. So a bike would be the first choice. I think you're right, Jill. But yeah, I think that's what I would do. Or walking outside, as long as you're safe, not to fall. The only issue with that is sometimes, and you can let us know, Nick, if it's painful to have that traction of the weight of your arms while you're walking.
Mm. Oh, definitely. Yeah, I definitely hurt. Yeah, I got a Vicodin, so. But,
so yeah. those would be great questions for the physician you're seeing. And can I start with therapy? What can I do? And they'll give you some very specific guidelines because you have to be very careful about moving that shoulder, the clavicle fracture side, because you don't want to put too much traction on that clavicle fracture yet. At some point when it's a little bit more stable, you do. So kind of what I tell people when they have a fracture and things are knitting back together, the analogy I give people, I hope this one's better than the horse. is it's like a doily. It's like the lace doily at your grandma's house. It's loose and it's kind of like a spider web and it's not very well connected. And if you tug too soon, you're going to rip it. But when it gets a little bit more solid, you actually do want to put a little tension on it to kind of promote the healing process. And looking at imaging, things like that will be something that will kind of guide how that healing process is going for you. So you got a lot going on, Nick.
Yeah.
And so
in terms of the crystal ball, we can't tell you if you're going to need surgery on that or not. That would be a question for the physician.
Right.
Good luck, Nick. Thank you very much for calling. Heidi emailed and has rheumatoid arthritis. Her elbows are most affected and is losing strength. She said she cannot fully extend or contract and said exercises like push-ups, planks, or down dog are impossible, and even stretchy hands are painful. She wonders if you had any exercise recommendations.
Well, it sounds to me like she would do better in a non-weight-bearing position, because the planks she's talking about, those downward dogs, are all putting a lot of body weight through her arms. So I'm wondering if doing something open chain, Lori, would be better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly what we call open chain, where your hands are not fixed on a solid object. So any kind of arm raising, elbow bending, I mean, there's a number of things to try. Mm-hmm. It may be painful to grip. You can get little wrist weights that go around your wrist. Those would work. Again, we also put people in the pool. And any kind of resisted walking in the pool, just walking in the pool, will give a gentle resistance to her entire upper extremity as well as her legs. So, and the warmth of the pool often feels good for those folks.
Mm. And if she hasn't seen a physical therapist for her rheumatoid arthritis, since this is a systemic condition, it's probably a good thing to see a physical therapist for 1 to 2 visits and kind of help guide Heidi on load, exercise progression, things like that.
And it would be useful to see an OT to find appropriate tools that she can use at home to decrease the stress on her wrists, hands, and elbows.
So an occupational therapist.
Yep.
Okay.
Occupational therapist.
A listener emailed and had spinal fusion surgery in October. They're recovering and taking 2-mile walks 2 weeks post-surgery. Diligent about wearing the lumbar brace and following restrictions. Very active, but nervous about having a setback.
So it sounds like this person is doing well. 2-mile walks, those are fantastic. So when people are anxious about stuff, I tell them about the rule of threes, and that is you have to be able to do the same exercise program at the same dosage for 3 sessions in a row before you increase. That way we superimpose that dosage of activity on day-to-day variations in their pain level and their activity level. So we make sure that the physical therapy dosage is not going to aggravate their underlying condition. And then they can increase gradually. Apparently at the same pace that this person has been increasing seems to be working. So the biggest risk at this point in time would be a slip and fall, more so than just the walking itself.
Right.
And Tom emailed, maybe here's a quick one we can do. 80 years old, weight stretch routine every other day and rotor cuff exercise recommended by a physical therapist. And where can Tom get his exercise routine evaluated to ensure it is good enough? I would think back to the physical therapist.
That's exactly right. I think that's a great call, Larry. Have if you got some rotator cuff exercise from a physical therapist, taking that whole wellness program that he has established and making sure it's appropriate for him, it's of adequate load, all the major muscle groups are covered, a physical therapist could help him with that and also implement perhaps some cardiovascular conditioning for Tom as well.
And on that note, I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually the way it works. Thanks, everybody, for your calls and emails. And Lori and Jill, thank you so much. Great to have you with us. And we'll look forward to your next visit next month in 2022.
Sounds great.
Well, thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Have a great rest of the year, everyone.
Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison. Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. They'll be back again on January 17th. Looking ahead to tomorrow, veterinarian Bill Stork is back to take your pet care questions. That's tomorrow at 11. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.